Hello, I'm John Callender, and this is my unauthorized audio commentary track for The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, the extended edition. This is my commentary on disc one of the two-disc set. For other commentaries by me, including my commentary on disc two, you can see my website at www.lies.com/DVD. I remember sitting down in the theater to watch this movie for the first time, and the sense of excitement I felt at the way they held on that black screen as the music and Kate Blanchett's voiceover began. I thought it really did a good job of setting the mood leading into the movie. The extended edition is obviously the only one worth viewing for an obsessed fan now that it is available. I'm not the most obsessive fan by a long shot with respect to The Lord of the Rings, but I am a lifelong fan of these books, and I'm a big fan of these movies as well. This prologue sequence, as you know if you listen to the director's and screenwriter's commentary track, was added fairly late in the process of making the movie. They went back and forth on whether they needed it, whether they didn't need it. Was it going to be something that would sort of kill the momentum? Was an audience that wasn't familiar with the book going to sit still for this extended history lesson in the previous events in Middle-earth? But I think ultimately what they came up with really worked very well and does a very deft job of doing just that, of incorporating that backstory in a way that's satisfying both to longtime fans of the story like myself and to newcomers who are coming to the movie without knowing the books. I'm going to talk about that theme a lot in my commentary, the way the screenwriters managed to strike a balance between those competing needs, and the director, Peter Jackson, as well, and all the people working on the movie. I think it's something they were obviously all conscious of as they were making the films. Here we have some opening shots showing the massive software's output, which is going to be much more significant in part two and part three of this movie. I've always liked Hugo Weaving's intensity in that shot we just saw with the arrows flying past him, ruffling his hair, but it doesn't phase his concentration at all. I always thought it was interesting the effect they used with Sauron there, where the mist or steam or smoke or whatever it is that's coming out of him is sort of being sucked back into him. It's pretty obvious that all they did was they simply reversed that. They took that shot and they just played it backwards. So instead of backing away from him, they filmed the actors representing the elves and men approaching him fearfully as the smoke wafted off him, and then they just played it in reverse. This explosion of Sauron and the shock waves that sort of blast out from him is reminiscent at this point, of course, of the effect they used for the destruction of Sauron and Barad-dûr at the climax of The Return of the King. And in many ways, this prologue sort of sets up that climax some 12 or more hours of movie later. Here's the first additional footage in this extended edition, where the waylaying of Isildur takes somewhat longer. You get a little more detail. In The Fellowship of the Ring, I think the extended edition add-ons were not so dramatic an improvement to the original movie as they were in The Two Towers. They were more just nice additions, sort of icing on the cake, especially, again, for the fan of the books who got to see some moments that they filmed and worked into the story, but then cut out of the original theatrical release. In just a moment, we'll get our first view of Gollum. At the point when they were making this prologue, they didn't really know what Gollum was supposed to look like, or how the effect was really going to be achieved, so they kept it minimal. They didn't show you much of him. That last view there, of course, was Diagol's hand pulling the ring out of the bottom of the river, which you learn when you see the lead into the Return of the King. There's our momentary view of Gollum. They're not showing him doing much moving. They're not showing him in much detail, which certainly works fine for the purposes of the prologue. There's no reason to make him more obvious at this point in the story. This part here with the voiceover lines about darkness creeping back into the world and the way they show the moon through the trees and the ripples on the water, sunset, or I suppose sunrise. I think it does a good job of conveying the passage of time and the creeping of evil back into the world. It's a good example, I think, of Peter Jackson's effectiveness as a director. It's not an obvious way to show that concept, at least to me, but I think it works well. I think of Peter Jackson not so much as a visually stunning genius of a director, although there are certainly plenty of beautiful shots in The Lord of the Rings. I see him as more of a journeyman than a great artist, more of a craftsman. And I actually think that that's a good thing, rather than a weakness, in terms of his being the person who directed these movies. I'll talk about that more a little bit later. Here we have the new beginning sequence for the extended edition, which was actually an alternate beginning that they had tried using at one point and then rejected for reasons that, again, they talk about on the official commentary tracks. To someone who loved the books, this alternate beginning really is a lot of fun, showing the map, showing these details of Bag End. When the film was being made and some footage, well, some still photos and a little bit of footage, but mostly just still photos, were being leaked out onto the net, in the, at that point it was well over a year before the movie's actual release. The care they were obviously taking with creating the look of the film, the way the Shire looked, the vibrant green grass and the details and the images that became available. It really looked like a real place, and a place that actually lived up to my imagination, and I'm sure lots of others' imagination of what Middle-earth and the Shire should look like, which was a nice thing to see, a hopeful sign at that point. It was, of course, way too early to be confident in what the final result would be, but it gave us reason to hope. More nice little bits of Hobbiton here. And again, more nice details of Bag End. These sort of cute little bits really do honor the book's opening, where it spends a considerable amount of time talking about hobbits and what they're like and what sorts of things they like. In the theatrical release, this was all tightened up considerably, and I think that was a good choice. You know, that the movie was certainly long enough as it was, and for that movie-going audience. But again, it's nice to get all the details back as a fan of Tolkien. Now we've entered into the theatrical release's opening, with the arrival of Gandalf and Frodo greeting him. I remember seeing the movie for the first time, sitting in the theater there with my equally obsessed wife. And I think it was right along in here somewhere in the next few minutes. We'd seen the prologue and we'd seen a little bit of the Shire, that we both leaned our heads together and whispered excitedly to each other simultaneously, "This is really good." That was a moment I think I'll always remember. I think every fan of Tolkien on some level wants Middle-earth to be real, to have it be a real place that you could actually go to. And the care they took to make this movie look and feel real was a huge part of its appeal for me at least, and I think for a lot of people like me. This sequence here, where they're on the cart, is a good illustration of the idea of scale, how they worked hard on the movie to create this sense that hobbits were small, you know, 3 to 4 feet high, and they'd look that small next to a full-sized person like Gandalf. They talk extensively in the official commentary tracks about the different ways they used to achieve that. They consciously tried different means of showing scale of the different races, different kinds of tricks and special effects. They'd have small doubles, big doubles, duplicate props in different sizes, blue screen sections where they'd film the actor against a blue screen and then put a different sized set behind them, CGI, you know, straight computer graphics, and forced perspective shots like they do on the cart, where in the shots where you see both Frodo and Gandalf, Gandalf looks bigger because he's actually closer to the camera. And when Frodo and Gandalf are looking at each other in those shots, they're actually looking past each other, in front of or behind the other actor, into empty space. Sometimes I think the tricks they use to show scale work better than others. And certainly, having watched the movie so many times now and figured out what they're doing in each of the shots, you can start to see through the tricks. I don't know that it works so well that I'm blown away in a "you will believe Elijah Wood is 3 foot 6" kind of way. It's not always perfect, but it's good enough, I think. It's good enough to get you to suspend your disbelief and get you sucked into the story and the actors' performances, which is all it really needs to do. This old guy coming up, the hobbit that they pass, who sort of scowls at them and then laughs at Gandalf's fireworks and then scowls again when he's busted by his wife, I assume. He's played by Noel Appleby, and he's credited as Everard Proudfoot, though until I noticed that, I always assumed he should be Odo Proudfoot, based on Tolkien's account of the events later at Bilbo's birthday party. But anyway, I think his expression in this shot coming up is great. The shot always gets a big laugh every time I've seen the movie in a theater, and with good reason. I think it's just a great sight gag. And it's another example for me of Peter Jackson's journeyman filmmaking. It's very direct, Not subtle. We need a laugh at this point in the movie, so here's a laugh. To me, again, Peter Jackson isn't like a Kubrick or a Coppola or a Scorsese. Those kinds of directors can just stun me with their visual genius. They can just take me outside of myself with awe at what they put on screen. Peter Jackson, for me at least, at this point in his career, he's a step below that level. To me, he's more like a Steven Spielberg. He has a certain raised on television directness and economy. He's willing to use a standard film vocabulary, sometimes bordering on a cliched film vocabulary, that sometimes is arguably fairly cheesy, which is a word he uses a lot in describing things he's done in the official commentaries. At heart, and I think Peter Jackson admits this, he's really just an overgrown kid who wants to make zombie movies. But again, I think that was actually a strength, not a weakness, in terms of what he did here on these movies. The scale, by the way, there where Gandalf and Bilbo are meeting outside Bag End, I think works really well. I've always been so focused on the actors' faces in those shots that I don't really even notice how they're switching back and forth between the actors and the scale doubles as the camera angle changes there. Here's more great detail for fans of the book as we see more of the inside of Bag End and the cute little bonking of the head by Ian McKellen here. He sells that really well. This is a great detail for fans of Tolkien, the way they managed to work in the map of the Lonely Mountain from The Hobbit, not so much from The Lord of the Rings. It's not just gratuitous, though, that it's there in the movie. It serves a purpose in the story. It helps show how Bilbo is thinking about leaving the Shire. He's been pulling out his old maps, thinking about his old adventures. And you can get that without having to know the backstory. You know, there's an old map with a mountain and a dragon on it. But if you know the backstory, it's more. And they do it all in just a few seconds of screen time. There's an interesting forced perspective trick coming up. The table that they're sitting at here is actually in two pieces, and the far end of it is being moved from side to side by a motion control system to keep everything lined up and maintain the illusion whenever the camera does these movements. You don't see it so much in this shot, but there's another shot of the same table in a few minutes where the camera sort of glides to the left. And it's really more clear in that shot if you know what you're looking for. It's a very clever trick that they did, since normally with forced perspective shots, you know, the giveaway is that the camera is always fixed in one position. So here they found a way to actually move the camera, and it really helps keep you guessing, I think, on how they're achieving those scale effects. I'd like to say I figured that out on my own, but I didn't. They show how the thing works in the documentaries on the extended edition. If you've never seen the French and Saunders parody of The Fellowship of the Ring, by the way, you really should. French and Saunders are a British comedy duo who do a TV show. And in their send-up of this movie, they have a lot of fun with the idea of scale. And they do a very funny version of this scene where the two actors get mixed up about who should be using the big prop mug and who should be using the small one. I've heard that Peter Jackson has seen that parody and loves it, and I'd heard there was a chance of it finding its way onto one of the DVDs as an Easter egg or a special feature, but so far, no luck with that. Maybe in the Return of the King extended edition, if we're lucky. In a minute, we're going to start seeing the fireworks at Bilbo's party, and I want to talk about those a little bit, because I really do love what they did with them. But first, there's going to be a great example of how a movie can do certain things that the books can't. In the books, you hear about Rosie Cotton, not so much in the beginning of the story here, but more in the end, in the scouring of the Shire sequence that was removed from the movies. And Rosie is supposed to be this pretty young hobbit lass who's captured Sam's heart, and that's fine. I can imagine that as a reader. But in a movie, you can actually put an actress like Sarah McLeod on screen, and for a member of the audience who's wired the way I am, it just has a qualitatively different effect. Something that movies can do that books haven't quite managed to do yet. But to get back to the fireworks, Gandalf is famous, of course, in Middle-earth for his fireworks. It's a big part of his character, as described in both The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, at least in terms of how he's seen by the hobbits. So they had a lot to live up to in this part of the movie for fans of the story. And I want to read a passage from Tolkien, if you'll bear with me for a moment. Here's how he described the fireworks at Bilbo's party. There were green trees with trunks of dark smoke, their leaves opened like a whole spring unfolding in a moment, and their shining branches dropped glowing flowers down upon the astonished hobbits, disappearing with a sweet scent just before they touched their upturned faces. There were fountains of butterflies that flew glittering into the trees. There were pillars of colored fires that rose and turned into eagles or sailing ships or a phalanx of flying swans. There was a red thunderstorm and a shower of yellow rain. There was a forest of silver spears that sprang suddenly into the air with a yell like an embattled army and came down again into the water with a hiss like 100 hot snakes. And there was also one last surprise in honor of Bilbo, and it startled the hobbits exceedingly, as Gandalf intended. The lights went out, a great smoke went up. It shaped itself like a mountain seen in the distance and began to glow at the summit. It spouted green and scarlet flames. Out flew a red golden dragon, not life-size, but terribly life-like. Fire came from its jaws, his eyes glared down, there was a roar, and he whizzed 3 times over the heads of the crowd. They all ducked, and many fell flat on their faces. The dragon passed like an express train, turned a somersault, and burst over Bywater with a deafening explosion. Now, the action here has certainly been modified from the book. They've worked in the business with Sam and Rosie, and Bilbo telling the troll story to the cute hobbit children, including Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh's kids, who have cameos in each of the movies. And there's the great introduction of Pippin and Merry, really showing you what their characters are all about. But through it all, they keep the fireworks very much as Tolkien described, and visually they're as impressive as anything I could have imagined. Again, every example of the fireworks they show here is straight from that description I just read, and faithful in not just in the overall sense of it, but actually in fairly specific details. And they didn't have to do that. They could have, done perfectly well without doing that, but they chose to, and I really appreciate that they did. There's some more great stuff straight from the book, as Bilbo addresses the crowd in a moment here, including Everard, Proudfoot's proud feet, and also the less than half of you compliment that goes over the heads of the hobbits. In some ways, I think that those top-tier directors I was talking about earlier, people like Scorsese and Coppola and Kubrick, they would have really gotten in the way on this project. They wouldn't have been content to make J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. They would have had to make it over into something more fully their own. And I didn't want that. I wanted Tolkien. Peter Jackson, though, I think, really offered a perfect balance. Here's someone with enough experience with special effects to pull off the special effects in the movie, but as he said, enough experience with them to know that the movie couldn't just be about the special effects. They had to be means to an end, where the end was telling the story. So again, you've got Peter Jackson, someone who I think has enough talent and ego to be willing to take on a project like this and successfully complete it. but not so much talent and ego that he would have screwed it up. This farewell, I think, is very nicely handled, where Ian Holm rests his eyes on Frodo at the end there. It's just a very touching moment. In the book, of course, Gandalf has a little pyrotechnic distraction at the moment when Bilbo disappears, specifically to avoid the hobbits really getting the full effect of what he did with the ring, and sort of cover up the fact that Bilbo is using this magic ring that can make him disappear. But I think in the movie it's a good choice that they give us the more direct version, since Gandalf's trickery would have probably had the effect of confusing any number of people in the audience as well. This is kind of cute, I think, some sort of low-grade wizardry, the way Gandalf gets to Bag End ahead of Bilbo and is just standing there waiting as he comes in. This scene has been criticized by some for how the digital compositing that they did, taking the two different sets of footage of the two different actors and putting them together in the one scene. It doesn't quite work exactly right. Bilbo and Gandalf seem to be looking not quite at each other a few times when it seems they really ought to be looking at each other. But I don't know, it didn't bother me the first time I saw it, and it really doesn't bother me now. I think it works just fine. The look that Ian Holm's going to give in a moment when he says the line, "My precious," and he widens his eyes. I really like it. It's no fancy special effects, just great acting. They get a lot of good mileage out of Ian Holm's acting abilities here, really helping to explain the emotional content of Bilbo's relationship with the ring, and sort of foreshadowing the possession of Frodo by the ring that's going to take place over the course of the three movies to come. The way they make Gandalf grow menacing in this shot here, where the room darkens, it just really impressed me. It's again straight from a scene as given in the book, but it's something as a reader of the book that I've never quite been able to visualize. And even now, as I watch it on screen over and over and over again, I'm still not quite sure how exactly they achieved that effect. But I like it. It really works for me. More great stuff here with the two actors with their large and small doubles to help with the sense of scale, and again, I don't notice it at all. I'm just so focused on the actors' faces. Now, this moment coming up where Bilbo, having been reminded by Gandalf that he still has the ring in his pocket, and he actually does give it up voluntarily, it's really quite a significant moment in the history of Middle-earth for a Tolkien fan. And it's very impressive what Bilbo does here, given how long he's been under the ring's influence. And viewing the scene with that in mind, I think Ian Holm does a great job showing the inner struggle he goes through, and then the relief tinged with some regret that he feels afterwards. That, of course, is one of two cases, the only two cases in the entire history of the ring, where someone in possession of it gave it up voluntarily. And of course, you get the second of the two in The Return of the King, when Sam gives the ring up to Frodo. I like this moment a lot. Again, just getting these two great actors on screen and coming up tight on their faces the way Peter Jackson likes to do. It just works very well for me. So we are working some more to convey the sense of power and menace in the ring, making everyone jump momentarily. The look that Ian McKellen's Gandalf gives to Frodo here in a minute, I think is just great. I just really love it. When he tells him the line, "Bilbo's ring," and sort of looks at Frodo, there's just a hint there of foreknowledge of what's to come. At this point, Gandalf hasn't worked it all out, but he's got some doubts. He has at least a premonition. Frodo, of course, has no idea what he's getting into. But Gandalf does have some idea, and I think Ian McKellen really conveys that well with just those two words, and a brief glance. Just great acting there and great direction, the way we closed up a little bit on Ian McKellen's face as he was delivering that, just focusing our attention there. This shot coming up where Gandalf looks at Frodo through the chandelier, I always really like. It's one of those silly little things that Peter Jackson does throughout these movies, but it just really works for me. It just adds that element of visual interest, that dynamic sense, telling that story, keeping me involved in the story. I've been talking about scale, the scale of hobbits versus humans versus whatever. I think they do a great job with showing scale here by swooping over this tower and giving you a sense of how large it is, and only then do you realize that it's actually just a tiny little piece of this much larger structure being built here, as Barad-dûr is being assembled. In this shot, it's our first view of the Ringwraiths riding out, not from Barad-dûr, as I think a lot of people assume, but actually out of Minas Morgul. And of course, if you listen to the actor's commentary track, you get the thoroughly Tolkien-obsessed Christopher Lee setting you straight on that point. And then here is our first view of Minas Tirith, which again will be such a prominent part of The Return of the King. Well, Gandalf certainly seems to be treating those ancient parchments with a very cavalier attitude, just piling them up one after another and doing who knows how much damage to them. Well, I suppose the reference librarian of Gondor is not there to watch him. I like this effect coming up here where the ring shrinks in Isildur's hands. It echoes a passage in the book that talks about the ring's ability to do that, and to do it unexpectedly, slipping off your finger or when you don't expect it to. This hobbit that we're going to see in a moment, talking to the Ringwraiths, is actually Farmer Maggot, according to the credits. And it's nice to have him show up in the movie, if only in this abbreviated form. He has a significantly larger part in the book, but again, it's nice how they managed to work him in, including even the part about how his dog reacts to the Ringwraith. And here with our extended edition, we get a little bit more of this bit of fun at the Green Dragon Inn. Including in a moment, we're going to see some some characters who in the book show up a little more in the scouring of the Shire part at the end of the books. Although again, they won't be in the movie so much. Presumably we've got Ted Sandyman there smoking. Some of these old guys, and we must have the gaffer, Sam's father. And Daddy Twofoot, the gaffer's next door neighbor, and old Noakes of Bywater. And more Rosie Cotton, which is always fun. Another nice light moment here with the joke, Sam misinterpreting Frodo's comment about Rosie knowing an idiot when she sees one. This moment here, the sort of faux tension that they build up, is one of those movie cliches, certainly in how it's shown to us. But I think it works well in terms of just ratcheting up that tension to another level. Longtime fans of Peter Jackson describe this as a classic PJ shot, Elijah in that close-up with the hand reaching out from the darkness behind him. These are all, of course, iconic moments from the books, given to us very faithfully here. Even down to little details like Frodo's hand sinking there as the ring hits it. You know, the book describes how the ring was strangely heavy, as if it had grown heavier in the flames. And they work that in there. More great acting by Ian McKellen here, especially, you know, the play of emotions he gives us as he's seeing his worst fears confirmed. And here working in these lines of Tolkien's. Of course, were the words that Sauron spoke when he had created the ring and first placed it on his finger. Here's more of the forced perspective table that moves to keep the perspective looking right as the camera shifts back and forth. Here we're getting more pulling in tight on Ian McKellen as he's explaining all this important information. There's really a lot of plot being laid down here for those unfamiliar with the story, and it's important that it be able that it be delivered in a way that doesn't bore the audience, doesn't lose their interest. And with no real action taking place in the scene, it's really all up to Ian McKellen to just maintain that interest, to deliver these lines in a way that keeps us on the edge of our seat. It conveys the emotion. And I think he just does a great job. Elijah tells on the commentaries how this was his first blue screen shot that he did. He strides forward there. Here's a scene, Gollum being tortured. Doesn't happen on camera, so to speak, in the book. We only hear it alluded to by Gandalf in describing again what happened to Gollum, and a little bit later on in the story, Gollum himself alludes to it. Here's our first gratuitous beheading. First of many. And here again, we have more fairly vital plot information if the story is to work from a logical standpoint. We need to know why can't Gandalf take the ring? He's powerful. Can't he do this task better than Frodo? But as he explains here, no, he really can't. And it's all up to Ian McKellen to sell this, to make it seem credible, to drive the story forward. If he fails, you know, really the story isn't going to work. But I think he does a great job. And again, this sense of pity he shows, this regret he feels for what he's putting Frodo through, is, I think, very well done. I like how they achieved this bit with Sam coming in through the window in a moment. Again, very, very true to the books. Sean Astin's line that he gives about hearing something about the end of the world, but nothing important. I think it's one of the funniest lines in the movie. The first time I saw the movie, surrounded by fellow obsessives in a packed theater, that line got a huge laugh. But on subsequent viewings, the crowd really seemed not to get the joke, or certainly not as much, which I think might be the result of people who are not so familiar with the story. So they're having to concentrate more on just all this plot information that's being laid down here. Or they're more concerned for what Gandalf might actually do to Sam. So they're just not in a position to appreciate the humor quite so much. Obviously, I saw this movie many times in the theater, and that was an interesting process for me. I've heard other longtime Tolkien fans describe the same thing, of almost having to rewire my brain in order to enjoy the movie. I basically know the books by heart, and I have my favorite scenes that I always look forward to. And the first time, especially, that I was watching the movie, I was so busy looking for those favorite scenes and cataloging all the ways that the film was and wasn't staying true to the books, that I wasn't able to just relax and enjoy watching it. With the second and subsequent viewings, I actually found myself enjoying the movie more, especially in those moments that either weren't in the book or were in the book but weren't my favorite parts of the story, but that somehow in the movie have become real emotional high points that I've really come to appreciate and enjoy. Here's a blooper coming up where supposedly, if you look close, you can see a sneaker on Elijah Wood's feet, right there, I guess. I've never actually been able to see it, but people talk about seeing these things. Sometimes I wonder with some of these bloopers if they're just, you know, people seeing what they want to see, and if they want to see artifacts and mistakes, they'll find them. Another goof, according to many, is that corn shouldn't be here in ancient Europe. That's a New World plant. The same criticism gets made a little later about the tomatoes they're eating at Weathertop. But I don't know, we're in a past so far back in these stories that I think I'm okay with the idea of some New World plants existing in the Europe of that time. You know, organisms are found in different places at different times across thousands of years. I think it's possible, if not actually the case, that, you know, tomatoes could have died out in the old world and lived on in the new. But That's probably not true. This, by the way, is one of my favorite additions to this extended edition. Them working in this bit with the elves. The way they show the elves in slow motion, and the ethereal music, and the way the elves are glowing with this inner light. It really evokes the elves' mystery and beauty, and Sam's comments about them are a nice echo of his character's obsession with elves at this point in the story, in the books. In a moment here we have the first appearance of Orthanc, and there's a moment as Saruman walks forward with Orthanc behind him that just really looks to me like a blue screen shot. We'll see it in just a moment here. Oh yeah, and this scene, this was talked about in the early reviews I was reading of this movie before I'd seen it myself, people who were fortunate enough to see it before its official release, that moment as the Nazgul sort of walks on camera and adds that element of menace to the idyllic view of sunrise over the Shire. I think I was expecting more when I actually saw it, but I think it works fine, but it didn't really blow me away in the way that that particular reviewer talked about. This shot here, as Saruman comes towards us with Orthanc behind him. Something about it just really looks like a blue screen to me, as I was saying right here. Just lighting or something just doesn't seem to quite work right. It may actually be the difficulty of filming Saruman's hair against that backdrop that makes it just not seem quite realistic to me. There's a popular comic genre on the net of people doing secret diaries of Lord of the Rings characters. If you go search around, you can find some witticism based on that. And there's one recurring gag you see in a lot of places, which has Saruman, or sometimes Legolas, obsessing over his hair. Saruman telling Gandalf he really must try this new cream rinse he's discovered. And it actually does make a nice contrast in the movie in terms of their characters, having Gandalf all ratty and unkempt. While Saruman's hair is perfectly shiny and straight. As someone who, for a time, had hair pretty much as long and as straight as Saruman's is here, I can appreciate the amount of effort the wizard must have devoted to keeping himself looking well-groomed. Christopher Lee, as I mentioned earlier, is a huge Tolkien fan. I've read the books repeatedly, every year or two, since first discovering them as a teenager in the mid-1970s. Including reading them aloud all the way through with my wife and daughter several times. But I was put firmly in my place by the discovery that Christopher Lee has been doing pretty much the same thing since the books were first published in the 1950s. It's great, I think, that he was able to be part of these films to bring his respect for the material and his concern for the adaptation's authenticity to the movies. Like a lot of people, I was saddened to hear that his final scenes as Saruman ended up on the cutting room floor in the theatrical release of The Return of the King. And I'm looking forward a great deal to December 14th, 2004, when those scenes will be restored as part of the extended edition. This wizard fight scene coming up, I've heard mixed opinions about it. Personally, I think it's fine. I'm happy not having the cliche of bolts of pyrotechnics coming from the wizard's staffs as they fight each other, and instead having something that seems a little truer to me to how wizards like this, should they actually exist, might fight each other. Here we have the beginning of the great fight scene. At the MTV Movie Awards, this was offered up as one of the great fight scenes to be voted on 1 year. I don't recall if it actually won or not. Those awards are always so silly in comparison with the real awards, like the Golden Globes or the Academy Awards. But this, I think it works fine. It's a little bit campy, but what are you going to do? You've got Christopher Lee in a classic horror movie scene. I'm going to camp it up a little bit. More old world corn here. And in a minute, Sam's going to report having been told by Gandalf, "Don't you leave him." And in the book, of course, Sam basically reports being given the same advice, but in the book he's given the advice by those elves that they were seeing earlier. Their leader, Gildor, the elves spoke with Sam, and their leader, Gildor, had an interesting discussion with Sam about the Black Riders. Frodo asked Gildor who or what those Black Riders were, since at that point in the book he'd seen them a few times at a distance. And Gildor, learning that Gandalf hadn't told Frodo anything about them, answers, "Then I think it is not for me to say more, lest terror should keep you from your journey." And Frodo answers, "I cannot imagine what information could be more terrifying than your hints and warnings," which I think is a pretty good point by Frodo. But in the end, Gildor will only tell him, "Is it not enough to know that they are servants of the enemy? Flee them, speak no words to them, they are deadly. Ask no more of me. But my heart forebodes that, ere all is ended, you, Frodo son of Drogo, will know more of these fell things than Gildor Inglorion. May Elbereth protect you." Peter Jackson says in the commentaries that this shot coming up where they sort of change the focal length of the camera to give you that zoom effect as they're staring down the road with the Black Riders coming was borderline cheesy, cliched. And we've certainly seen it before in other movies, but I think it works fine here. I think it's actually a pretty effective way of leading into the upcoming scariness with the Nazgul. That shot there, of course. Much is made of the goof, if you want to call it that. How in this shot you see the Ringwraith emerge from behind the tree, but you didn't see him heading into the area behind the tree beforehand. But I think that's fine. He might have come up from more directly behind the tree and turned at the last minute, or it could just be part of his sneaky Ringwraith nature to have slipped into view that way. The Ringwraiths in the book are so terrifying. They just ooze terror. If you're in their presence, you find yourself just losing the capacity for rational thought in your fear. And I don't know that they manage to really convey quite the degree of fear that the book's description does with these little bits, the insects crawling out of the ground and all. But I think they do, again, a good enough job to move the story along, and I'm not sure how they could have done any more there. Of course, there's a lot of story being compressed here, for a fan of the book. The way all this action moves in a fairly small amount of screen time, it covers tens of pages of plot in the book, which is always sort of the knock on Tolkien from his detractors, is this idea that you're exhausted at the end of the Lord of the Rings because you've had an epic quest as every bit as endless and exhausting as what the characters in the story go through just to get through Tolkien's descriptions of getting his character from point A to point B to point C to point F to point G to point H. But anyway, here in the movie, they do, I think, a very deft job of cutting through all of that. And this sequence, this whole extended sequence here, I think is the best example of that. I'm not sure what that bright halogen floodlight is doing in Middle-earth, backlighting that rider there. But it does look awfully cool. In her commentaries, costume designer Nyla Dixon talks about how much work went into making those Ringwraith costumes, the yards and yards of fabric, and all the effort to get all the layers arranged just so. But it certainly looks great when you see them on screen. It helps really convey that sort of tenuous, kind of amorphous quality that their descriptions of them give them in the book. This whole sequence here is invented in the sense it's not from the original story. It's all part of the sort of deft bridging I was talking about. The fairy is in the book, and the Black Rider arriving there just not quite in time to catch them is in the book, but it's a much less dynamic scene in the book. The book really hasn't ratcheted up to this level of action yet at this point. But the movie clearly needed it. We're an hour into the film now with the extended edition. And they needed some action. And here we are, right to Bree, right at the entrance to the town of Bree. So what was left out there for a fan of the book? Well, there were four whole chapters, basically. The Hobbits spent the night at Crick Hollow, where they have a fairly suggestive communal bath scene. For that subset of Tolkien obsessives who like to look for gay references. Then they get lost in the Old Forest, a place with dangerous trees, and are rescued and end up staying the night in the home of the comical and mysterious Tom Bombadil and his wife, Goldberry. Then they leave Tom, only to need his help again shortly thereafter when they are waylaid by an evil undead creature called a Barrow-wight. So all that has been skipped over in the movie. Speaking of Tom Bombadil, there's a long-running controversy in the Tolkien community over the question of just who Tom and his wife actually are. They seem very out of place in Middle-earth. They're quite powerful. Tom's magic is even shown to be stronger than the ring at one point. Yet the other characters in the story really have no clue where they come from. In later years, Tolkien wrote that he meant for Tom to be an enigma, that he felt that any realistic fantasy world needed to have one of those. But in fact, he left clues in his writing as to who Tom and Goldberry really are. And it's actually pretty cool when you figure it out. I'm not going to reveal the secret here, but I'll give you this pointer. Go to Google and look up Gene Hargrove's essay, "Who is Tom Bombadil?" Hargrove is right, and everyone who disagrees with him is wrong. So, now you know. They do a great job in this Bree sequence of showing you the hobbits in increasing jeopardy. You know, they've left the Shire, the very insular world of just hobbits, and moved out into this world of Bree where hobbits and men interact with each other. They do a good job in the movie of conveying that aspect of what Bree is like, that it does have these humans and hobbits mixing together. The two peepholes in the gate earlier, you know, the human height one and the hobbit height one, I think were a nice touch. And in a moment here, we'll get our first view of Aragorn. Cast late, of course, after filming had already started, to replace the quote-unquote too young Stuart Townsend. I've always wanted to know more about what actually happened there with the casting of Stuart Townsend and the decision to replace him. It's treated uncharacteristically coyly in the commentaries and the documentaries on these extended editions and in the other materials on the movies that have come out. I'm sure that's appropriate. They're not looking to make Stuart Townsend out to be a bad guy. Peter Jackson has just said many times, well, we had just cast him too young. But certainly, they were in big trouble at this point in the movie when they started filming and suddenly had to replace a major character. You have all those tracks laid down in that train of the production rumbling along, and you can't stop it at that point. And they're very fortunate, I think, to get Viggo Mortensen at the last minute. That shot we had of him a second ago, with his face illuminated by the glow of the pipe bowl, it just, to me, perfectly evokes the passage in the book where Tolkien introduces him. Ian McKellen has talked about Frodo's nails in that last shot. He thinks Elijah Wood is very brave, showing that he bites his nails to the world. But I always thought it was perfectly in character. Frodo's anxious. He's been through these terrible experiences, and so he's biting his nails down to the quick. And the fact that they're dirty is just another example of that gritty realism that I really love in these movies. These shots of what the world looks like when Frodo is wearing the ring are really fantastic. It's one of those things that Tolkien describes more in terms of its effects than its actual appearance in the book, leaving it to the reader's imagination what it would actually look like. But the way it's depicted in the movie works really well for me. It's better than I could have imagined. Peter Jackson's kind of almost disparaging in describing the effect as something that was so simple to achieve, unlike some of the other effects. The actual computer graphics work or whatever it was that allowed that effect to be created, I guess, was relatively easy, but I think it really works well. The scene in a moment where the Nazguls ride down the gate and squash the gatekeeper underneath the gate. It's almost Monty Python-esque to me. It's always struck me as really silly. But again, a movie has to be entertaining and have some action, and Peter Jackson obviously isn't above using something that's, again, borderline cheesy in order to achieve that. And so he does, in a moment. Aragorn's look here is a little, seems to me a little bit different than the look we get of him later. Not sure exactly what it is. He just seems a little bit of a different Aragorn there, and I'm not sure if that reflects his character's intentional development over the story, or if it's more just the evolving sense the filmmakers had of how they wanted Aragorn to look at any given time. There's a shot here in a moment that I never noticed at first, and then again, watching these movies with the commentaries, Peter Jackson mentions it, and now that I look for it, I can, I never, I now always see it. I can never not see it. There's a moment where we're going to see Frodo looking out the window, and the camera's going to dolly back away from the hobbits in their beds. And as the camera passes him, Frodo will lean back into the frame. He couldn't be in his final position because the camera wouldn't have had room to get past him. So he just does that little move as the camera passes. And it completely breaks the fourth wall as a viewer if you recognize it. But again, I never recognized it until hearing him describe it. Right here. It always makes me crack up now when I see it. Here's another deft segue where we compress a lot of action from the book into just a quick cut in the movie. In the book, there's all kinds of plot to get through at this point, but in the movie, you just cut, and there they are, Striders leading them into the wild. Coming up in just a moment here. more of this sort of different look Aragorn here. So here we are, in the wild, bypassing all that plot. In the book, there's a whole sequence that next morning after the Nazgûl attack. Their ponies have been stolen, along with all the other horses and ponies in the stables. And Aragorn frets about needing to get at least one pony as a pack animal for their journey. So they end up buying an emaciated, ill-treated animal from this smarmy Brelander human named Bill Ferny, who appears a little more in the story, has some more connection with the nasty events of the night before that are sort of summarized in the film version. Anyway, and they're on their way out of town, finally, and they pass Bill Ferny's house, and when Ferny comes out and taunts them as they're going by, he really is just a despicable character. Sam throws an apple that he's eating and hits Bill Ferny in the nose with it, and it's a cute scene in the book. And here, I think, the filmmakers give us this oblique reference to it that I'm sure none but the obsessive fans would notice, but I'm equally sure was actually intended as an oblique reference, where we get Pippin hit in the nose by an apple. That horse in that shot is basically two extras in a horse suit, two people in a horse suit. Something that, again, I never noticed in watching the film until I heard it described in the commentary tracks. Here in this extra little bit, we have Aragorn singing the Lay of Lúthien. As Tolkien obsessives know perfectly well, Aragorn and Arwen's story is in many ways a recapitulation of the love story of Beren and Lúthien, which is described in the Silmarillion. In the appendices to The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien tells how the young Aragorn was singing one day as he walked alone in the woods of Rivendell. Tolkien wrote, "And he halted amazed, thinking that he had strayed into a dream, or else that he had received the gift of the elf minstrels, who can make the things of which they sing appear before the eyes of those that listen. For Aragorn had been singing a part of the Lay of Lúthien, which tells of the meeting of Lúthien and Beren in the forest of Neldorath. And behold, there Lúthien walked before his eyes in Rivendell, clad in a mantle of silver and blue, fair as the twilight in Elvenhome. Her dark hair strayed in a sudden wind, and her brows were bound with gems like stars." And that was Tolkien's account of the first meeting of Aragorn and Arwen. I rarely see these scenes with Christopher Lee building his orc army or Uruk Hai army. Because I tend to skip them, because I'm a lot of times watching this movie with my 6-year-old son. And if he sees too many orcs, he has nightmares and comes in and wakes me up in the middle of the night to snuggle in my bed. So, as I say, I tend to skip over those scenes, which with DVD technology is actually pretty easy to do. I like this shot, the top of Orthanc. Gandalf is described as being imprisoned there in the book, but we don't certainly get that visual sense of what it looked like. This business of focusing on Saruman's destruction of the trees is important, of course, in building up to what's going to happen there in the Two Towers with the attack of the Ents and their Huorns from Fangorn Forest, their attack on Saruman. And here we have Amansul, or Weathertop. In Unix culture, it's common to name your servers after some theme, and for many years my servers have all been named after towers and hills in Middle-earth. I've had Ithil, Anor, Andros, Bree, Din, the computer I'm recording on right now, and the machine I actually used during much of the time I was obsessively following these films' development at websites like theonering.net. A G4 Power Mac named Sul, after Amansul, or Weathertop. Not sure where those swords that Aragorn just gave the hobbits came from. Has Aragorn been carrying them with him the whole time? Were they cached somewhere nearby? In the book, those swords came from the hoard of the Barrow-wight, but since we don't have the Barrow-wight in the movie, we needed them to suddenly just appear so the hobbits could use them in the upcoming battle for all the good they do. The way that this scene, the Nazgûl's attacking them on Weathertop, is staged is a significant departure from the book. The book scene is so creepy and so memorable to me that it was something of a disappointment to me to have it be replaced with this version in the movie. In hindsight, I can appreciate that the book's version is probably close to unfilmable, and certainly it lacks that level of action that for pacing reasons, something he talked about throughout his commentary, Peter Jackson felt he needed at this point in the movie. Sean Astin tells a fun story about how disappointed he was about this scene. He, along with the rest of the cast, had been spending months training for this role, including sword training, and this was the first time he was going to have a chance to use it. And he was all set to do all these awesome sword moves, and Peter Jackson had to bring him back down to earth by telling him, "Well, actually, you're just a little hobbit, and in fact, in this fight, you're going to get spanked." Well, or words to that effect. There's also a mention in the commentaries about how this was Viggo Mortensen's first day of shooting, just a few days after learning that they wanted him for the role, in fact, and how he really had pretty much no clue what he was doing with the sword in this sequence. But legendary Hollywood sword master Bob Anderson, who worked on the film, took him through it shot by shot, and it turned out okay. The way the Nazgûls look under their wrappings is great here. It's just a fantastic effect that really lived up to my hopes. Bob Anderson, the sword master, of course, has made a big deal about Viggo Mortensen's impressive education on this film in the way of the sword, as he puts it, and says that he's one of the most gifted swordsmen he's ever trained. Here comes Viggo doing his faux sword fighting. I had a fun moment. The recent Summer Olympic Games, I was watching some of the obscure sports that TiVo technology made it easy to watch. And my daughter and I ended up watching some fencing. And as we were watching it, she commented to me, "This isn't sword fighting. I want to see real sword fighting, like in the movies." Because it was all so fast and it would last a second or 2 seconds and be over before they'd reset and go back in. There was none of that hacking back and forth, hack, 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 like you always see in movie sword fighting. And Bob Anderson talks about that, I think in one of the documentaries on this set, this DVD, about how, movie sword fighting really is not the same thing as real sword fighting. It has its own logic, which I think Viggo Mortensen did do a good job of picking up on quite quickly here. In a moment, we're going to get this long, long shot. Here we are here. of the bigature of Orthanc. It's the very large miniatures that they made. And Peter Jackson talks about how it's sort of standard director's dogma not to use long shots with miniatures, that the effect won't hold up, and you'll end up looking silly if you show it for too long in an unbroken sequence. But he does here, and I think it works great. The illusion never gets broken for me. This looks like I'm flying over Orthanc. Of course, the moth has been added here. We need a mechanism for Gandalf to communicate with Gwaihir, the eagle who rescues him, which in the book is done by Radagast, the brown wizard, one of a large cast of minor characters that's been written out of the movie in the interest of economy, keeping things as simple as possible for those who don't follow the books. And I think it was a good job with the addition of the moth. It feels true to the original to me. It doesn't bother me. That plunge from the top of the tower on down into the dungeons has been talked about a lot by critics as sort of a signature Peter Jackson shot. And it certainly works. This scene coming up in a moment where we see the Uruk-hai warrior being birthed is somewhat controversial in the obsessive Tolkien fan community. It isn't described anywhere in Tolkien. There's really no description of where the Uruk-hai come from specifically. Are they born? Are there orc women? It mentions Uruk-hai being sort of crosses between orcs and men, but it's never made clear how exactly that crossing is achieved. Here, I guess they're represented as being something like test tube babies who are born fully grown from these pods. This scene here, where the newly born Uruk strangles the orc and Saruman prevents his other orcs from interfering, is sort of a standard movie bad guy scene. More of that Peter Jackson sensibility. We need some evil here, so here you go. Some classic movie evil. And who better to play that scene than classic horror movie villain Christopher Lee? We're going to meet Arwen in a moment, which brings up a fairly large change from the movie, excuse me, from the book to the movie. We've completely eliminated the character of the elf prince Glorfindel and given his part to Arwen. Arwen glows in this upcoming shot where we first see her, by the way, because Frodo is passing into the spirit world, which in some sense is the same world he's in when he's wearing the ring. And as he sinks deeper, the real world recedes and grows shadowy and dim. This is the effect of the Morgul blade with which he's been stabbed. But certain things, fire, the Nazgûl beneath their wrappings, and elves, exist in both worlds, and so they remain visible to him. And so this shot here, Arwen glowing, this is how Frodo sees her, complete with her inner glow and a different set of clothing. And I'm not sure how familiar, I mean, how clear all this is to people who are not familiar with Tolkien. I suppose it might be a bit confusing when we switch in a second to the viewpoint of the other hobbits, and Arwen looks completely different. It actually reminds me, in that sense, a little bit of The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, where you see the red lectroids as aliens or as humans, depending on whether the character whose viewpoint you're currently using is immune to their electrochemical brainwashing. But getting back to Arwen, I was a skeptic early on of the Arwen changes to the story. During the filming, there were lots of rumors among Tolkien fans about the liberties they were taking with her character. They were putting her in the battle at Helm's Deep. They were making her into Zine Arwen, as some of the most outraged fans described it. And around the time all those rumors were going around, I participated in a fan question contest that the OneRing.net did, where they collected and you voted on questions to be put to the filmmakers as part of an Ask Peter Jackson event. My question, which concerned these changes to Arwen, actually received the most votes, so I had the pleasure of watching Peter Jackson answer my question in a video clip. And his answer was great. He kind of chuckled and said, "Relax." which turns out to have been really good advice. Yes, they were making some changes, he said, but they were basing most of their depiction of Arwen on Tolkien's own material from the appendices. And we know now that they ended up abandoning that whole warrior princess idea early on and gave us an Arwen who falls much closer to her character in the books. And regardless of, whose influence that reflected, who among the filmmakers, I think what they ended up with, for me, as the person who actually voiced that question for Peter Jackson, I'm completely happy with. Liv Tyler's portrayal of Arwen has ended up being one of my favorite parts of the movie. This whole sequence here with the horse chase is another example of something that I had heard described before I went and saw the movies by some of the early reviews, and it just didn't sound to me like it would work as standing in for the way this whole sequence was played out in the book. Logically, they've telescoped some geography here, and I mean, here they are racing along. How long are they racing for? It's not clear. But watching it on screen, I think it works perfectly well. I saw an interview with Liv Tyler where they were talking to her about this writing, and the breathless bubblehead interviewer said to her something along the lines of, "And did you really ride your horse through those scenes?" And what they showed in response is Liv Tyler sort of jokingly saying, "Yes." Which I'm sure was a joke, because in plenty of other interviews I've seen her do, she goes on and on about the actual stunt horsewoman who rode in those scenes. But it's just an example of how they can edit things, and as an actor or an actress, you're really not in control of how you're going to be presented to the world. Having Arwen actually perform the magic of that raises the waters here, I think works well. It keeps the action more on screen. In the book, it's Elrond who does this off camera, and you only learn about it later. But I think this effect of the flood and the white horses, which the book tells us Gandalf added as his special touch to the magic here, is very well realized. This part coming up, where Frodo collapses and Arwen is suddenly concerned for him and sounding very distressed with her "Frodo, don't give in" line. It always seems somewhat abrupt to me. In the book, Arwen eventually does give up her place on the ship that carries the elves to the Undying Land so that Frodo can take it and find his peace at the end of the story. So I guess this was an allusion to that, a way of tying her character in more closely with Frodo and with the main action of the movie. But again, as coming from the books, it just seemed a little abrupt to me and a little out of place. Something that I forgive in lots of other places in the movie, so I don't know why it continues to bother me on some level there. This awakening of Frodo in the House of Elrond, of course, foreshadows the awakening he has after the climax in The Return of the King, where he's in Minas Tirith, or Ithilien in the book, after the ring's destruction. I really like the architecture they created for Rivendell. Just the style of it. This moment they give us with Gandalf on the roof on the top of Orthanc, the Tower of Orthanc, where he's rescued by the eagle, I think just really works well. It's just a nice little action sequence that the way they visualized it, just the shots they used. This really has some great memorable moments. This shot here, or the version of it we see in a moment where the eagle comes swooping in over the moon, is just, I think, a great way of sort of visually telling the story, tying the moth there with the eagle, showing the moth fluttering in front of where the eagle's going to come, just to make it a little more clear what all's going on. I also really like this shot we get here of Gandalf astride the eagle. I think I can understand their choice to have Gandalf ride the eagle that way, rather than being clutched in eagle's talons, which is how the book describes it. Sean Astin, I think, tells a story about how Ian McKellen approached him in before the filming of this upcoming scene, and mentioned to him how important the hand-holding was that Sam does, where he comes and grabs Frodo's hand. It's a significant moment in the book, and as I recall hearing the story, Ian McKellen, reminded Sean Astin that, look, for gay fans of Tolkien, that moment's going to be very important. And it's an important indicator of the love, the platonic love, certainly as far as Tolkien tells us, between Sam and Frodo, how strong that love is. That moment there, a moment ago, when Hugo Weaving says, "Welcome to Rivendell," of course, as always, done as Agent Smith with, "Welcome to Rivendell, Mr. Anderson." Just sort of an inevitable joke. Here we have the reuniting with Pippin and Merry, and in a moment with Bilbo. And we'll see then that Bilbo has aged dramatically, which is described in the book, and I thought realized quite well on film. This, of course, is the effect of Bilbo's having given up the ring, which was unnaturally prolonging his life. What the movie obscures, though, is the question of how much time has actually gone by between now and the last time that Frodo saw Bilbo when he said goodbye at his party. In the book, it's actually 17 years that goes by. Frodo going from 33, which is actually the coming of age for a hobbit. Hobbits age somewhat more slowly than humans, so they have their irresponsible tweens, where we have our teens, and then they come of age at 33, where we come of age more at, say, 21 or even 18. Anyway, so at this point in the story, in the books, Frodo is 50 or 51 years old, which is the same age Bilbo was when he went on his adventures in The Hobbit. So a lot of time has gone by. In the movie, clearly, even with the effects of having the ring around and with hobbits aging slowly, it's pretty hard to credit Elijah Wood with being 50 or 51. They just don't talk about it, which I think works fine. It doesn't enter into the story, and it all makes sense, and Bilbo simply aged that much more dramatically, and that's fine too. There's a moment here where Elrond and Gandalf have a discussion, and Elrond is presented as fairly mercenary, at least to my mind as I'm watching the film. And I think that's fine. We're keeping the story moving along, we're maintaining tension and building it. This scene we have Frodo realizing that, yes, actually my part in this story could be over, and that sense of relief is, I think, well conveyed by this scene. But of course, Frodo has the corresponding reluctance to give up the ring that anyone who's possessed it would feel. That was, again, shown so well with Bilbo when he was leaving the ring for Frodo. Here's the scene I was talking about, where Elrond seems to almost have a to take a malicious glee in thinking about what they could, how they could use this hobbit in an effort to deal with this ring. I love Hugo Weaving's delivery of that line about our list of allies grows thin. And this part about how Saruman has crossed orcs with goblin men, it's sort of an interesting construction in that Tolkien uses goblin pretty much as a synonym for orc. In The Hobbit, he calls them goblins. In The Lord of the Rings, he calls them orcs. So I'm not sure what a crossing of an orc with a goblin man is supposed to mean. In the books, it's presented more that the Uruk-hai are created by some crossing of, again, of humans and orcs. In a moment, we're going to see the arrival of our other members of the Fellowship, Boromir and Gimli and Legolas. And when I saw this in the theater the first time, as again, I was surrounded by a lot of obsessive fans, there was one woman who just had to scream at the top of her lungs every time she saw Orlando Bloom on screen, which was cute the first time it happened, but after a while it became a real pain. In some ways, watching these movies on DVD is a better experience for me. They don't have all those other obsessives around me whose obsessions intrude upon my own enjoyment. I guess I'm just antisocial in a way that probably a lot of geeky computer geeks and Tolkien fans probably are. Harry Sinclair, the Down Under filmmaker and friend of Peter Jackson, who Jackson cast as Isildur, Jackson jokes about having cast him that he was the most corruptible looking or evil looking actor he could find to play that role. Here we just it's nice to just have a bit of a reminder, just helping us remember this is what happened, and some more detail about what happened, so we're learning a little more than we did in the prologue. How Isildur chose not to destroy the ring. And in a moment, we're going to have a scene with some Boromir in it. Sean Bean is Boromir. As a fan of the book, I was never very fond of Boromir. You know, he's the one who betrays the Fellowship, and I think Tolkien's depiction of him is not altogether sympathetic. And I wasn't a huge fan of Sean Bean coming into this movie. I'd seen him in the James Bond movie, Goldeneye. But I think that was it. I'm not sure if I even saw him in anything other than that. And, you know, knew of him as an actor, but wasn't necessarily thrilled about his being included in the cast when we were first learning who was actually going to be in the movie. But Sean Bean brings so much to every scene that he's in this movie. He pretty much upstages Aragorn. Upstages Viggo as Aragorn in their every appearance together, including this scene. My growing admiration and enjoyment of Sean Bean's portrayal of Boromir in these movies is a prime example of the thing I was talking about earlier, where there were things I came to enjoy after I'd sort of deprogrammed myself as an obsessive fan of the book, and was able to appreciate more and more as I watched the movie more and more. If you've listened to the cast commentary track on this disc, which you certainly should, you know that they recorded it in different groups and then edited it together afterwards. So the comments kind of take different directions. You've got the four young hobbits in one group, and they're always telling jokes and telling funny stories about each day's filming and where they were and what they did. And then you get Ian McKellen, who talks a lot about sort of the craft of acting and his work he's done with these and other actors. But Sean Bean, in his commentary, talks almost exclusively about Boromir, the character, his motivation, his struggles, his flaws. And it's really fascinating listening to him do that. It reflects a real commitment by the actor that totally comes through in his performance here. And in a moment here we have Arwen arriving. The scene on the bridge coming up in a minute between Aragorn and Arwen with the song by Enya, it's so beautiful, it always gives me chills. And to me, the whole movie just ratchets up a big notch during that scene. Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens, screenwriters of the film, along with Peter Jackson, talk about how Peter had relatively little interest in writing scenes like that. They'd let him, excuse me, they'd let him do the fight scenes. The script would just have the direction, you know, they fight, and they'd leave it up to Peter to flesh that out with some action. But scenes like this one coming out, like this one or the one coming up on the bridge, the two women screenwriters really worked very hard on. There's so little, really, for women in Tolkien, which was a real challenge, I think, in making this film. And giving it some on-screen romance in a form that a mainstream audience would expect, while still being true to the books and not alienating obsessive folks like me, was an important goal, and I think they really succeeded here. And in fact, you know, this scene is one of my favorite scenes in the movie. Liv Tyler's delivery of the line, "I choose a mortal life in a moment," is so cool. It's an act of rebellion on her part, and there's an awareness of that in how she delivers the line. There's a mixture of fear and bravado. I don't know, something about her expression when she gives that line, it just really works for me. That hesitation she has there, the sort of vulnerability. You know, you can forget that she's a very, very old elf in that moment. And here we have the infamous Council of Elrond scene. In the book, it's basically presented as the business meeting from hell. A bunch of people around, sitting around a table, talking for hour after hour after hour, all recounted in painful detail over some 40 or 50 pages of the book. Peter Jackson has said it was the hardest challenge he faced in adapting the book to the movie. And I think overall he did a great job finding a way to keep it moving, to get out the bits of the plot that needed to be gotten out there to advance the story, and still have it be concise enough for a film audience. And still believable and satisfying for someone who knows the original material that's being summarized so aggressively here. Regarding this dream that Boromir recounts, what the movie doesn't make clear, but which is made clear in the book, is that the dream actually came first to Faramir, Boromir's brother, many times, and it only came once, finally, to Boromir. And as I read the book, I'm always wondering if Boromir, in the throes of his sibling rivalry and his ambition and his desire to lead the city and lead in everything, didn't finally just say he'd had the same dream. Or maybe he talked himself into it, I don't know. It was nice to have this little bit where Gandalf speaks the Black Speech of Mordor, have that added back for the extended edition. It's one of the more dynamic moments from the original scene as given in Tolkien, so it's nice to have it here in the movie. Here's more scene stealing by Sean Bean, the speech he gives here. I think is fantastic. The contrast here between Boromir's deep-voiced, powerful speech and Aragorn's almost whiny sounding, "You cannot wield it." always shocks me. I find myself wondering if that was done intentionally by the filmmakers in an effort to give Aragorn's character more of a dramatic arc, to heighten the tension by making him seem less kingly now, so he has a more visible journey in growing into his kingship. What a great line. He has delivered that sneer. And of course, a great bookend with Boromir's speech in his death scene that we'll talk about in Disc 2. In a moment, of course, Gimli's going to grab an axe and try to destroy the ring. And those who complain about movie goofs have often mentioned that Gimli destroys his axe here, and then has his axe a moment later when he pledges it as to, employ it as part of the fellowship. But of course, it makes sense. Gimli didn't use his own axe on the ring. He picked up the axe of the dwarf sitting next to him, leaving his own axe intact. With that dwarf sitting next to him, presumably, at least based on the version of this scene in the books, being Glóin, his father, a dwarf that readers of The Hobbit will remember. More heavy lifting here in an acting sense by Sean Bean. Helping convey in a sort of visceral way what they're up against, which was a real challenge throughout all of these movies, given that so much of the film's antagonist is off camera so much of the time. You never really see Sauron. You see relatively little of Mordor. The ring itself is just this little inanimate object that they have to imbue with all this magic and power and menace. And you do that with acting. You do that with great acting, like Sean Bean does in this scene. This argument that the council kind of devolves into, I'm sure helps the movie from a dramatic standpoint, but I find myself really missing the conclusion of this scene from the book, where everyone is at the council table in silence, just looking down and seemingly lost in their own thoughts. At the moment when Frodo, reluctantly delivers his line about how I will take the ring to Mordor, though I do not know the way. I really love that moment in the book. And again, I mourn its loss a little bit in the movie version, even while recognizing that this version does work better on screen. In the book, it's just Sam who's eavesdropping on this scene. Merry and Pippin don't find out about the outcome of the council until later, and they have to press their claim to be included separately. And for a time, Elrond is actively resisting their request to go along, which I think is an interesting moment in the book. You have Elrond depicted as being in disagreement with Gandalf on this larger issue of sort of strategic thinking, who should make up the members of the Fellowship to go on their quest, and they have this discussion, Gandalf and Elrond do, about whether it's better to include some powerful member of Elrond's household, like Glorfindel, some elf prince with, a long history of bravery and borderline magical ability, as the elves who traveled to the Undying Land in the first age before returning to Middle-earth, all have. But again, we need to compress this for the purposes of the movie, and I think it compresses quite well. And once more, we're helped by the comic stylings of Billy Boyd. A great, great line there about where are we going? So the movie continues on disc two, and this unauthorized commentary continues in part two, which you can find at my website at www.lies.com/DVD.